In reviewing the news of any year, it's necessary to look for a theme, a thread which runs through the months and gives events a meaning, places them in proper perspective. This is Bill Scott, Director of News for Radio Press International. You are about to hear the major news stories of the year, exactly as they happened, and the reporters who covered those stories and saw developments mark 1964 as the year the post-war era ended and the world embarked on a new course, a course as yet undefined, but charted by this knowledge. Science has given man the power to prolong and enrich life, and to end it swiftly in a single stroke. Nations were less inclined to base national policies on hard sets of ideologies in 1964. Scientific and economic terms replaced political slogans in many countries. New technology permitted some nations to play new roles on the international stage. In 1963, the sounds of the news had overtones of tragedy and death. Here are some of the sounds of the news of 1964, not all soothing, but generally less ominous and reflecting more caution.
Firmness will always be measured.
South Carolina cast 16 votes for Senator Barry Goldwater.
American people to know that I am the greatest.
In nostro incontro con l'India.
Let us get together, unite, plan a program of activity, and the program, and we'll win.
Listen now to the stories behind these sounds. On 1964, Year in Review.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
This is not a conservative philosophy. This is not even a Republican philosophy. This is not a philosophy ever embraced by any major American leader. Conservative may be written on their banner and in their books, but radical is in their hearts.
The choices may have seemed simple. Behind them were 1,000 implications. This is Steve Nevis reporting on a campaign that began in February on the frozen turf of a political proving ground called the state of New Hampshire. Voters in the nation's first presidential primary were interested enough in the issues. The candidates didn't impress them very much.
If I'm not the nominee, I'll still be rich as Rockefeller. Goldwater at my feet on the extreme right side of the street.
So the Republicans of New Hampshire gave their convention votes to a man on the other side of the world, U.S. Ambassador to South Vietnam Henry Cabot Lodge. In April, Senator Goldwater began gaining ground in the race for the Republican nomination. His years of nationwide campaigning for party candidates and the conservative cause were paying off. When the Republican Platform Committee met in San Francisco during the week before the party convention in July, increasingly bitter differences between conservatives and the party's old line moderates caused an explosion. They agreed on nothing, and the platform went to an open convention where Governor Rockefeller sought a plank condemning extremism.
It is essential that this convention repudiates here and now any doctrine doctrinaire militant minority, whether communist, Ku Klux Klan, or Bircher.
He lost. The Goldwaterites prevailed as well on civil rights and nuclear policy. Nominee Goldwater chose Congressman William Miller for a running mate, and party unity became their immediate problem. The kind of unity Barry Goldwater and Bill Miller obtained was minimal, failing to extend beyond agreement that Republicans were, after all, Republicans. While the extremism issue shattered Republican solidarity, the iceberg-like qualities of the civil rights problem threatened the Democrats 1 month later in Atlantic City. Their virulent feelings were contained by the Credentials Committee, before which Mississippi's Freedom Democratic Party fought for recognition in place of the state's all-white delegation, while Alabamans joined their brethren in refusing to swear loyalty to the national ticket. No one was satisfied with the solution, but the South, it seemed, was lost to Senator Goldwater anyway. So the party maintained the course to which it was committed, nominating civil rights strategist Senator Hubert Humphrey for the vice presidency. Maybe the Democratic Party was holding together because of the tragedy it, with the nation, had suffered. That feeling built up to the convention's final night when Robert Kennedy, who had just stepped into the New York senatorial race under crossfire of carpetbagging charges, stood on the platform to thank his party for what it had done for his brother. Robert Kennedy, fighting back the tears to speak over the ovation.
I first want to thank all of you for all that you did for President John F. Kennedy. I realize that as an individual that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out in little stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
The campaign was like trench warfare, the protagonists never seeing each other because President Johnson preferred not to debate. Senator Goldwater, on the offensive, would lob a charge at the president, who would, at his leisure, try to disarm it. The tone of the campaign was fixed at the outset.
We believe in the individual. We believe that men can govern themselves. And they can best do these things without the restraints of dictatorship or paternalism.
I'm not one that thinks that you can just ignore this general subject of education, or that you can ignore this general subject of poverty and just say, well, if they are poor, they ought to have done better for themselves. I want the government to be a compassionate government and an understanding government and a government that wants to do something about them.
But nuclear responsibility became the major issue.
We could find ourselves in the 70s without a single one of the flexible manned weapons which give us the vital scale of a controlled, graduated deterrent rather than only a capacity for all-out intercontinental nuclear confrontation.
Loose charges on nuclear weapons without any shadow of justification by any candidate for any office, let alone the presidency, are a disservice to our national security.
The Republican nominee had been repeatedly charging the president with responsibility for Bobby Baker's misdoings. But Mr. Johnson didn't flinch until the GOP uncovered the arrest of his close aide, Walter Jenkins, for immorality. Senator Goldwater promised not to mention the Jenkins case unless it affected national security, but drew derisive laughter wherever he went by describing the president's staff as that curious crew. Mr. Johnson was astonished, then depressed, as he seemed to shed his self-confident campaign style for one more angry and determined.
Extremism in the pursuit of the presidency is an unpardonable bias. And moderation in the affairs of the nation is the highest virtue.
Suddenly it was over, though, and Lyndon Johnson's campaign theme took on new urgency after the landslide became apparent that night in Austin.
Our purpose must be to bind up our wounds, to heal our history, and to make this nation whole.
Senator Goldwater's concession statement was more like a battle cry.
This effort that we engaged in last January the 3rd turns out to be a much longer effort than we thought. It's not an effort that we can drop now, nor do we have any intentions of dropping it now.
He meant to hang on to the reins of the party organization. Other Republicans surveying the rubble had different ideas about removing National Chairman Dean Burch, finding new leadership, and about each other. Next, Herb Brubaker reviews the presidency in 1964, Year in Review.
For Lyndon Johnson, it was continuation and innovation, challenges of a new Western world and an old totalitarian threat. This is Herb Brubaker, Radio Press International's White House correspondent. John Kennedy's foreign policy was continued. Mr. Johnson sought also to improve contacts with European nations showing dissatisfaction with Soviet policies.
We must develop with our allies new means of bridging the gap between the East and the West. We shall neither act as aggressors nor tolerate acts of aggression. We intend to bury no one, and we do not intend to be buried.
Continued was John Kennedy's measured response. When Fidel Castro cut the water supply to the U.S. naval base at Guantanamo,
water can be brought in and will be brought in indefinitely from Fort Everglades, Florida.
And when Castro offered a limited supply, the president ordered Guantanamo's commander to cut the pipe. The measured response. When North Vietnamese PT boats attacked U.S. destroyers in the Tonkin Gulf's international waters,
air action is now in execution against gunboats and certain supporting facilities in North Vietnam, which have been used in these hostile operations.
Defense Secretary Robert McNamara comments on the mission's outcome.
The airstrike very clearly made clear to the North Vietnamese our intention to maintain our right to operate on the high seas. That was the objective. I think that has been accomplished.
The North Vietnamese superior guerrilla tactics combined with unstable government in Saigon made Washington's job frustrating and sometimes seemingly hopeless. But like his predecessor, Lyndon Johnson believed South Vietnam's loss could mean communist victory throughout Southeast Asia. When communist China exploded her first nuclear device, President Johnson said this.
Until this week, only four powers had entered the dangerous world of nuclear explosions. Whatever their differences, all four are sober and serious states with long experience as major powers in the modern world. Communist China has no such experience. Its nuclear pretensions are both expensive and cruel to its people.
As did John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson exercised presidential patience in working for freedom. In the difficult war in Cyprus, where Greek and Turkish factions fought, in Panama, where anti-American riots erupted, where there were demands for a new canal treaty, U.S.-Panamanian relations were severed. For almost 4 months, the president worked on reopening communications, then agreement.
We will reestablish diplomatic relations. We will immediately appoint special ambassadors with sufficient powers to seek the prompt elimination of the causes of conflict between the two countries, without limitations or preconditions of any kind.
Presidential patience in seeking expansion of the limited nuclear test ban.
We're proposing that both sides stop all production of the fissionable material that is used in nuclear weapons.
Presidential patience in refusing to draw rash conclusions when Khrushchev was ousted and Kosygin and Brezhnev took over the Kremlin. Mr. Johnson counseled free world unity while the West awaited Moscow developments. But unity there was not. One reason, a plan conceived by the Kennedy administration, continued by Mr. Johnson, the multilateral nuclear force, a NATO surface fleet manned by multi-nation crews. De Gaulle, seeking French hegemony in Europe, opposed the idea. British Prime Minister Harold Wilson, fearing the plan would give the West Germans nuclear weapons secrets, had his doubts. With the exception of West Germany, NATO nations were cool to the idea. But President Johnson persisted. called Wilson to the White House, extended a royal welcome. When it was over, Wilson gave his views.
They've been what I hoped for. Not only friendly, but practical. Getting down to cases and tackling each problem factually and frankly without frills. No theology, but a fast-moving, urgent, and down-to-earth approach to everything we discussed.
Continued was Kennedy humanitarianism when the U.S. joined Belgium in the Congo rescue mission. In domestic affairs, the president continued John Kennedy's commitment to civil rights, fought hard for passage of the historic equal opportunity legislation. The major Johnson innovation, for the first time in generations, a Democratic president got along with businessmen. And yet the president sometimes lectured them like a Dutch uncle.
Your task and mine is to make sure that that government functions, not to obstruct. I ask you what would happen to your business if each day your stockholders, and that's what you are, this government, spent all day long, like one or two of them do sometimes at annual board meetings, criticizing what you do and finding fault with everything you do and resolute against you every day. Just fast those mimeographs can turn them out.
A major reason for the Johnson business rapport was the president's emphasis on government frugality. He trimmed the budget to $97.2 billion. And Defense Secretary McNamara took this move, saving the government an estimated $500 million yearly.
We've identified 95 surplus, obsolete, unneeded facilities. These can be eliminated without in any way reducing our military strength or our combat readiness.
While the president made points with business, he impressed the poor with his war on poverty.
Our aim is not only to relieve the symptom of poverty, but to cure it, and above all, to prevent it.
While the president's policies kept alive the Kennedy image, the Warren Commission evoked a bitter memory. After months of investigation, it issued a voluminous report. Commission member Gerald Ford, Michigan Republican congressman, cites the commission's conclusion that Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin. And he adds,
there was no evidence found by the commission that proved a conspiracy, either foreign or domestic. Oswald acted alone based on what evidence we found.
Among other things, the commission recommended tighter presidential security, yet the nation feared for the president's security as he campaigned across the land, repeating his theme, "Let us continue." Continuation and innovation, the story of the presidency, 1964. Next, Don Folsom takes a look at the United States Congress in 1964, year in review.
The second session of the 88th Congress was good to Lyndon Johnson, responding affirmatively to nearly all of the new president's legislative requests. This is Don Folsom, Radio Press International's Capitol Hill correspondent. The administration's Medicare proposal, though passed by the Senate, died in the House. Its aid to Appalachia plan met a similar fate. But these were the only significant setbacks, and they were viewed as temporary. The president's congressional triumphs, however, were many, and at least two resulted in historic legislation, the biggest federal income tax cut and the most comprehensive Civil Rights Act. Neither bill was approved without a fight. Tennessee's Albert Gore led Senate opposition to the tax reduction proposal.
I'd like to kill it. It's a bad bill. It's a very unfair bill in that it gives the largest benefits to those who need it least. I will try to amend the bill in several ways to make a better bill out of a bad bill.
No crippling changes were made, and by February 26th, Congress had completed action on the bill, which reduced individual and corporate income taxes by $11.5 billion. The measure's Senate floor manager, Russell Long of Louisiana, then declared,
"This is the culmination of 1 year's work in the Congress by the House and the Senate. It is the largest revenue bill in the history of the country. This will be a bill not to tax the American people, but to untax them, and I'm happy to have played a part in that."
The Civil Rights Bill had a dedicated champion in its Senate floor manager, Hubert Humphrey of Minnesota.
really what we're arguing about and what the contest is about is the recognition of and the respect for human dignity. And until the United States of America strikes down segregation, and until we remove from our thinking and our practice bigotry and discrimination and prejudice, we have not fulfilled our obligation.
Passage of the 11-point anti-bias package was no easy accomplishment. It took 83 days in the Senate. Filibustering Southerners were led by Georgia's Richard Russell.
This is one of the most severe bills that has ever been presented to the Congress and is undoubtedly the most massive assault that has ever been made by statutory legislation on our constitutional system.
There was enough support for the measure if only it could be brought to a vote. It finally was. For the first time in the Senate's history, on June 10th, cloture was invoked on a civil rights debate. Late in the year, the Supreme Court upheld as constitutional the controversial public accommodation section of the 1964 Civil Rights Act. It was a case of the high bench agreeing with the Congress. The two branches don't always get along as well, as was evident after the court handed down its landmark one man, one vote ruling, which said that both houses of a bicameral state legislature must be apportioned on a population basis. Republican congressional leaders Everett Dirksen and Charles Halleck wanted the decision overturned.
Of course, abuses of geographic representation exist in some state legislatures and should be remedied. But is this the way to do it? We say emphatically no.
We Republicans believe the historic geographic population legislative balance, which has protected minority rights and interests for 175 years, should be maintained. We intend to support a constitutional amendment, if necessary, to rectify the Supreme Court's decision.
The House passed a bill denying federal courts apportionment jurisdiction. In the Senate, Dirksen attached to the foreign aid money bill a rider delaying reapportionment decisions. But liberals mounted a baby filibuster, forcing acceptance of a compromise sense of Congress resolution, which was later scrapped by a joint conference committee. And President Johnson, who had taken no stand on the touchy reapportionment matter, was given substantially what he had proposed for an overseas assistance budget, $3.5 billion. The chief executive also received close to $1 billion in congressional funds to begin his ambitious project to alleviate domestic poverty. Aside from appropriating money and making laws, Congress often investigates, or at least tries to.
Today's proceedings are an unconstitutional invasion by the legislative branch into the proper function of the judiciary.
Bobby Baker had somehow become a millionaire, by his own estimate, on a Senate salary of $19,500 a year. The Senate Rules Committee was charged with finding out if Baker had used his influential position as Majority Secretary in making the quick climb to wealth. In February, and again in December, Baker was called before the panel in public session. The results were the same each time.
I invoke the protection of the First, the Fourth, the Fifth, and the Sixth Amendments of the Constitution, and I specifically invoke the privilege against self-incrimination.
By year's end, the probe seemed to have raised as many questions as it had answered, and the hearings had become filled with partisan bickering and even shouting matches among investigators.
You will not be bothered with me again in your Rules Committee.
Well, you ought to at least tell the truth.
Now, that statement you've made is absolutely untrue.
Now, Major.
Now, listen, this is the first time in my life that an employee of a Senate committee in a public hearing has accused a senator of an untruth. Mr. McClendon had no business making such statements. I hope that he withdraws.
I had the same business making that statement.
Yes, and it's the Williams.
Well, you have not.
His.
John Williams, whose private detective work sparked the inquiry, had been sitting in on the hearings as an interested observer. But the Delaware Republican became disgusted with the way the committee was handling the probe and decided to take a walk.
I'm not walking out of here with any thought that I'm losing interest in this case. I have had my integrity challenged twice this week. The first time I overlooked it, I always give the man the second opportunity.
But no man gets the third opportunity to call me a liar.
Hearings were also held on the other side of the Capitol. The House Committee on Un-American Activities looked into an unauthorized trip to Cuba by a group of American students, but didn't learn very much from the uncooperative and sometimes rude witnesses.
I feel that these gentlemen are out to disrupt American society. And my rudeness was as a matchbox to the Empire State Building compared to their rudeness toward me.
A government report prompted another House hearing. U.S. Surgeon General Luther Terry, in making known the Public Health Service's findings on the relationship between cigarette smoking and lung cancer, had these recommendations.
I would advise anyone to discontinue smoking cigarettes. But if he were to continue smoking cigarettes, he should do so in appreciation of the health hazard.
The Committee on Interstate and Foreign Commerce held hearings on the matter, which turned into a forum for the tobacco industry after Dr. Terry announced that cigarette labeling and advertising regulations would be put into effect in 1965. Next, Noel Bernard reviews the year in Europe and Asia.
Internationally, 1964 unfolded in the shadow of the nuclear bomb. This is Noel Bernard, Chief European Correspondent for Radio Press International. The problems of nuclear balance and organization were the constant concern of diplomacy. On October 16th, Communist China compounded the problem by exploding its first nuclear device, thus joining the ranks of the nuclear powers, said United Nations Secretary General U Thant.
The Chinese test, in my view, is very regrettable.
Most other nations agreed. Inside the Western alliance, nuclear power was also creating strains and stresses. France went ahead with its program of nuclear weapons development, strongly urging Western Europe to form a pillar of defense independent of the United States. The United States offered Europe the MLF, a fleet of mixed manned surface ships armed with nuclear weapons designed to integrate Atlantic nuclear defense. President Johnson told Europe,
"We do not seek to have our way, but to find a common way."
Germany was torn between a pro-MLF government and a pro-Gaullist element. It was left to Britain to try and find a middle way. Prime Minister Wilson traveled to Washington for talks with President Johnson and found that
there is total identity of view between the United States administration and ourselves about the objectives we have set to guide our respective approaches to our allies and friends and our wider approaches in initiatives towards arms control and disarmament.
Wider consultations followed in several capitals, but as the year ended, the problem of reaching agreement on the nuclear organization of the alliance, while at the same time preventing proliferation of nuclear power, remained unsolved. Under the protective shield of East-West nuclear balance, conflicts abounded. The relentless war in South Vietnam showed no signs of ending. It was a constant preoccupation for the administration. To those overseas who wondered what was going on, Secretary of State Dean Rusk was announcing.
Secretary McNamara is going out this week to have a personal look at the situation, talk to our own leaders, Ambassador Lodge and General Harkins. And so we'll be looking forward to his report.
McNamara went back and forth across the Pacific, but there were more reports than victories, said one McNamara report.
The rate of kidnappings, murders, ambushes has increased very substantially. It's absolutely essential, therefore, that the government of Vietnam increase its activity to counter these attacks, and that we consider ways and means through increased economic assistance to assist the government of Vietnam in that activity.
The French contribution to the war in South Vietnam was not soldiers, but advice. President de Gaulle proposed a vague type of neutralization because, as his foreign minister put it,
the experience we've passed through for 7 years in a war that we waged in Indochina left us with the conclusion that it's very difficult to win a civil war, especially when a guerrilla type of civil war.
The Russians were even blunter in their advice, said UN delegate Fedorenko.
Our United States colleague should perhaps gather up his courage and fully recognize the guild. Remove the troops, stop the intervention, stop the violation of the integrity of a sovereign state, and the accusations were seized by themselves.
In spite of this sort of helpfulness, there was a lot of talk about expanding the war to North Vietnam. But the threat of Chinese and Russian reactions to such a move tended to slow it down. Britain and other allies did not like the idea. Harold Wilson told newsmen,
"We feel this would be extremely dangerous and would, of course, probably be ineffective, bringing more Chinese, and would be rather a parallel, perhaps, to what happened in Korea 14 years ago."
At year's end, the South Vietnam solution remained elusive. In Cyprus, too, there was conflict between Greeks and Turks. The whole Mediterranean flank of NATO was in danger of being engulfed. Frantically, diplomacy searched for solutions. At last, there was a ray of hope, as Cyprus Foreign Minister Spyros Kyprianou signified acceptance of a UN force.
"Well, we've made it clear that we would be prepared to accept an international force in Cyprus, provided such force goes there under a decision of the Security Council, and that the authority of the force is derived from the Security Council."
At year's end, the United Nations force is still in Cyprus, and though the danger has somewhat abated, Greeks and Turks are still not smoking the pipe of peace. Amid all the conflicts, the holy man in Rome carried on his peaceful pursuits. He opened the second session of the Ecumenical Council in Rome. Then he broke all precedent, traveling far and wide to spread the gospel of peace and brotherhood. In January, he visited Jerusalem, the first pope to do so since St. Peter. And in December, he flew to Bombay. Another man, not exactly a man of peace, but one who preached peaceful coexistence, traveled to Egypt and Scandinavia in 1964. But on October 15th, the political career of Nikita Khrushchev was brought to a sudden and unexpected conclusion. Throughout the world, there was much speculation about the reasons for Khrushchev's downfall. But the new Moscow team of B&K quickly sent its ambassadors to reassure world leaders that no change in Soviet policies was intended. There was change at the top in Britain, too. Following nationwide elections, Harold Wilson and his Labour Party were returned to power after 13 years of uninterrupted Conservative rule.
"I have just come from the palace where Her Majesty invited me to form an administration."
Hardly back from the palace, Wilson found himself deep in a balance of payments crisis. To reduce imports and expand exports, he slammed on a 15% surcharge on imports and gave exporters a 2% bonus.
"The first essential is a strong economy. This alone will enable us to maintain the value of the pound, and that lies at the heart of all we want to do to make this country strong again, of everything we want to do to improve conditions here in Britain, and of all we intend to do to help weaker and poorer nations overseas."
In India, the great man of non-alignment, Jawaharlal Nehru, died to be followed by Prime Minister Shastri.
"He was a great personality. I know my own limitations and shortcomings. I do hope I shall be able to discharge my duties to the satisfaction of our countrymen."
Those briefly were the highlights of a year in which the nuclear menace continued to hang over mankind. Next, a review of the year at the United Nations in Africa and in Latin America.
The United Nations peacekeeping efforts in the Congo, the Middle East, and on Cyprus captured most of the headlines during the year. But it was the financial crisis, in part created by these operations, that at year's end threatened to shake the very foundation of the glass wall tower along New York's East River. This is Mel Ligon, United Nations Bureau Chief for Radio Press International. The opening days of 1964 brought a conflict in Panama to the floor of the Security Council. Riots touched off by the heat of an election campaign and an attempt by Panamanian students to raise their country's flag on an American school ground in the Canal Zone resulted in a number of deaths. When the matter reached the Security Council, Panama's ambassador, Aquilino Boyd, charged the United States with aggression against his countrymen.
The Republic of Panama is being made the victim of an armed attack on its territory against its civilian population committed by the armed forces of the United States of America, garrisoned in the Canal Zone.
Ambassador Adlai Stevenson replied
that the distinguished ambassador of Panama presumes to make charges of aggression, I must say, surprises me. I can categorically deny his allegations of aggression by the United States.
After a temporary break in diplomatic relations between the United States and Panama, calm was restored to that Central American country. During the year, much of Latin America seethed with unrest. In Bolivia, strikes in the tin mining industry touched off an uprising that brought a military junta to power. Argentina watched uncertainly as Juan Perón tried to return to South America, but was turned back at an airport in Brazil and returned to his haven in Spain. Cuba continued its efforts to contaminate its neighbors with the Castro strain of communism, but met with little success. At the end of the year, Castro sent one of his top aides, Ernesto Che Guevara, to the United Nations to address the General Assembly. His arrival outside the building was greeted with something less than all-out enthusiasm. As Guevara addressed the United Nations, a bazooka shell was aimed at the headquarters building from a location across the East River. The shot, believed fired by Cuban exiles, fell short. Despite the heat generated by the Latin American countries, both at the United Nations and at home, it was the crisis in the Congo and the conflict on Cyprus that threatened to put the United Nations in hot water. The dispute between Greek and Turkish Cypriots, which threatened to involve their mother countries in a major shooting war, led the United Nations to send a peacekeeping force to the Mediterranean island. The Security Council passed a resolution calling on all parties to keep their heads. The resolution was read by Ambassador Adlai Stevenson.
The Security Council, concerned at the serious deterioration of the situation in Cyprus, calls for an immediate ceasefire by all concerned.
But while the talk was cheap, the operation which sent and supported the UN force on Cyprus was not. And in August, Secretary General U Thant, asking for more money to keep the force on Cyprus beyond September, told the member nations,
if such support is not forthcoming in the immediate future, it would appear necessary that the force may have to be withdrawn even before the 26th September 1964.
More money was forthcoming. As the end of the year approached, the peacekeeping force was still on Cyprus, and the United Nations was again feeling the pinch in its pocketbook. August also was the month that saw the United States lash back at North Vietnam after American ships had been attacked in the Gulf of Tonkin. East and West traded charges and countercharges. Adlai Stevenson outlined the American view.
Aggression does not pay, cannot be sustained, and will be thrown back by people who believe as we do, that people want freedom and they want independence.
U Thant always had seen negotiation as the solution to the problem of Vietnam.
The only sensible alternative is the political and diplomatic method of negotiation, which, even at this late hour, may offer some chance of a solution.
But always it was the lack of money, funds to keep the United Nations going, that plagued the World Organization during 1964. The Soviet Union and other nations refused to pay for the UN's peacekeeping operations in the Middle East, Mediterranean, or Congo. The United States insisted the Soviets pay their share, or, according to the World Organization's charter, lose their vote in the General Assembly. The 19th session of the Assembly, delayed until after the American election, was expected to immediately grapple with this explosive problem when it opened in December. But the Congo stirred again and captured the attention as well as the resources of the United Nations. With this and other matters to deal with, and to avoid an open fight in the Assembly, U Thant proposed the matter of back payments be settled in a back room.
Issues other than those that can be disposed of without objection will not be raised while the general debate proceeds.
At the session's opening, three new members joined the world body, two of them from Africa, bringing the total UN membership to 115 nations. And Ghana's Alec Kazan Saki was elected president of the General Assembly, the first African of his race to achieve that distinction. In the Congo, self-styled leftist rebels expressed their opposition to the central government of Moise Tshombe and attacks on Americans, Belgians, and loyal Congolese. Many were savagely beaten and brutally murdered in an outburst of near cannibalism. The United States and Belgium cooperated in a rescue mission, dropping paratroops into rebel strongholds and freeing thousands. One of those liberated in Stanleyville was the American Consul General, Michael Hoyt, who told how he had been beaten and forced to eat an American flag.
At one point, we were forced to try to eat our flags, that it was too durable to to actually eat.
The rescue mission became the focal point of a bitter African denunciation of the West in general, and the United States and Belgium in particular. Mali's foreign minister, Ousmane Ba, in translation, charged,
under the umbrella expression of humanitarian action, the American and Belgian governments have undertaken against the innocent populations of Stanleyville and the surrounding areas one of the most murderous operations that has been carried out since the beginning of the Congolese crisis in 1960. This was a premeditated and cold-bloodedly carried out act.
The force of the African verbal assault shocked the West, and United States Ambassador Adlai Stevenson replied,
"Never before have I heard such irrational, irresponsible, insulting, and repugnant language in these chambers. And language used, if you please, sir, to contemptuously impugn and slander a gallant and successful effort to save human lives of many nationalities and colors."
As the end of the year approached, the United Nations could only hope for a respite from the turmoil in the Congo, although there seemed little reason for optimism. The financial crisis and negotiations to find a compromise solution to the payments dispute continued at United Nations headquarters. At the end of 1963, the United Nations was reported nearing bankruptcy. 1 year later, it apparently had not moved very far from the brink of financial disaster. Next, a review of the year's news involving civil rights, as well as a look at some internationally famous personalities on 1964 Year in Review.
People are most deeply involved in the human emotions of tragedy and joy, and 1964 had more than its share of both. This is Victor J. reporting the diverse stories of people in the news on Year in Review. The date is July 18, 1964. It is night. The weather is hot and so are tempers. And in New York's seething Harlem, anger over civil rights has turned into civil wrongs. Riots erupt, riots born of poverty and discontent, and fanned by extremist elements.
We are looking for 100 dedicated men who's ready to die. We are looking to get 100 very able and willing to be trained, skillful revolutionaries.
Life on New York, night of Birmingham horror. But now, brothers and sisters, let us get together, unite, plan a program of activity, and the program, and we'll win.
Across the North, from Harlem to Rochester to Philadelphia and elsewhere, a summer of discontent gives birth to a summer of violence on both sides.
As a mother, and as a parent of one of the three boys who are missing, I am making this plea to all parents everywhere, particularly to the parents of Mississippi, who, like myself, have experienced the softness, the warmth, and the beauty of a child whom they cherish and love and want to protect. I beseech your help and cooperation.
This is 21-year-old Andrew Goodman's mother. The trio she is talking about are three civil rights workers, two white men from New York, and a Meridian Negro. They are missing in June in Mississippi, and hope for them dies hard. To some, like the NAACP's Roy Wilkins, it seems right away that the hot Mississippi summer has claimed lives.
Knowing Mississippi, I prefer to lean toward the Mississippi solution, which is that they're dead.
On August 4th, the FBI finds the three bodies. Andrew Goodman and Michael Schwerner have been shot. James Cheney beaten and killed.
6 months after the homicide, 21 men, including Ku Klux Klansmen, the sheriff and deputy of the county where the killings occurred, and a minister, are arrested. But this is Mississippi, and many wonder if the convictions will ever be obtained. Nobel Prize winner Dr. Martin Luther King voices the fears of many.
Honesty impels me to admit that this will be very difficult. I'm always open to creative surprises, and I would certainly hope that Mississippi will surprise the nation and the world in this instance.
People make news in 1964. Liz Taylor and Richard Burton are finally married, as are Dutch Princess Irene and Spanish pretender to the throne, Carlos Hugo, after a stormy courtship opposed by the Dutch royal family. There are always those who will be missed at year's end. This year, Counts Douglas MacArthur and Herbert Hoover among those no longer with us. In the space race, 1964 is a quiet year. Three Russian spacemen are orbited for a short trip in October, but both East and West are preparing more manned space shots for 1965.
All cameras are functioning. We are still receiving pictures.
This was among the best sounds of the year in space. Ranger 4 finally makes it to the moon, sending back 4,300 previously unseen pictures before it crashes into the lunar landscape after its 250,000-mile journey.
Excellent signal strength. We're receiving pictures to the end.
Jacqueline Kennedy makes news during the year, although she would like not to. The president's widow and her two children move to New York and try to live a normal life, but it's not easy. The Kennedy Library Fund raises more than its planned $10 million, and Mrs. Kennedy thanks her countrymen.
We want this library to be so much more than a memorial to my husband's memory. I guess we really hope that young men whose names none of us now know will come to the library. It will excite their imagination and ambition, and they will go out and give us the kind of leadership my husband felt this country needed and deserved. That would have pleased him. That will make it all worthwhile.
The sports scene during 1964 is topped by baseball and boxing. Cassius Clay and Sonny Liston meet February 25th for a scheduled 15-round title fight. But Liston fails to come out for the seventh round because of a shoulder injury. Clay is the new world's champ, and he wants everyone to know it.
I want American people to know that I am the greatest.
Later, the Louisville Lip embraces the Muslim religion, and he schedules his rematch for November. But a hernia operation puts the fight off until spring. In baseball, both pennant winners are teams which were far back at midseason. The St. Louis Cards under manager Johnny Keene go on to take the World Series from the Yankees in seven games. And then a day later, Keene walks into the Cardinals' front office and hands in his resignation, decided on in September.
It has not been a spur-of-the-moment decision. Ms. Keene and I have talked it over very quietly, and we decided at that time that we were going to resign whether we won the pennant or not.
Less than 24 hours after that, Yankees executive Ralph Houk announces that manager Yogi Berra is also out, but not voluntarily.
Well, Yogi has accepted a two-year contract to work directly under me. And I think with his experience and his long term with the Yankees, knowing all of our players and our young players, that, of course, he'll be very valuable at that job.
Eventually, dissatisfied with his treatment at the hands of the Yankees' front office, Berra moves to the New York Mets to work for longtime associate Casey Stengel. As for the Yankees, before the year is out, they are sold to CBS for $14 million. The 1964 list of disasters includes the Good Friday earthquake in Alaska, Hurricanes Gladys and Hilda's vicious winds, and the crash in the fog-shrouded Atlantic waters of the liner Shalom and the tanker Stolt-Dagali. No view of 1964 could possibly be complete without a mention of the four young men from Liverpool who set the musical world on its ear. The word Beatles meant success in every way, in every land. The mop-top quartet is headed by elder John Lennon, who thought up the name.
I just thought of it, you know, as a name arose by any other.
Paul McCartney writes most of the songs.
What normally happens is that when sort of the girls are screaming, though, people notice it more. I think, you know, that it's a different kind of audience reaction to the one they normally get. I don't know, it's the young people's way of showing their appreciation. They love it.
George Harrison is the middleman, and Ringo Starr is the non-singing Beatle on the drums.
There's his second name Starkey, so you couldn't have a name like Ringo Starkey, so just cut it in half. So Ringo Starr it is, folks.
These, then, are the Beatles, part of the diverse world of 1964, year in review.
In these times of instant destruction, you could consider the very fact of having reached the end of a year an accomplishment in itself. And indeed, it is. But 1964 has put man on a course that may encourage him to consider each passing year as a stepping stone on a path that leads to the fulfillment of his hopes and dreams. In the year to come, there almost certainly will be crises. Much of Africa will enter adolescence, and the resulting changes will be felt in the East and West. While the Soviet Union makes what may be profound changes in its internal economic structure and becomes less of a threat to peace, Communist China seems likely to continue policies which have caused turmoil and death. Latin America, too, has yet to find a measure of stability, and 1965 would be unusual indeed if it passed without a political struggle south of the border. There will be changes in alliances, and relations will improve between some nations, deteriorate between others. Some countries will struggle to master newly found strength and importance. Others will stir uneasily as they assume lesser roles in world affairs. But to understand that man can be burned off the face of the earth in a nuclear flash, that the world itself can be destroyed in an instant, is to value life more. And this appears to be the lesson learned by man in 1964. How well he has learned this lesson, and how well he uses this new insight, will be the story of 1965 and the years that follow. This has been 1964, Year in Review, produced by Radio Press International. This is Bill Scott speaking.